Hey everyone, it's Hamish from the Young Investors Podcast. Myself and Brandon are excited to bring you your weekly rundown of the latest business and investing news from around the world. Now, a quick reminder before we get into the podcast is that nothing in this podcast should be taken on as personal financial advice. If you're ever unsure about your finances or investing, make sure you reach out to a qualified financial advisor. But with that said, let's get into another episode of the Young Investors Podcast.
All right, guys, welcome back to, what do we call this thing again?
The Young Investors Podcast.
That's right. How you going, Hamish?
Yeah, I'm doing well. Yeah, going well. It's been, had a couple of videos do pretty well, but the thing with having videos do well is every next one, there's just this bigger, at least a personal expectation to have an idea that's on par or better than previously, and to edit it and to produce it on par or better than previously. And it's always something I struggle with, which is like I have videos that do well. I'll have maybe like two or three in a row that do well. And then I just like I get blocked because every time I come up with an idea, I'm like, nah, it's not good enough. Like I have to scrap that.
It's not good enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I need to get past it. Yeah. I just need to like put the next thing out and just keep moving.
What your problem as well, I'm going to call you out for this, is when you have a really high performing video is that you also just like, job done.
Yeah. But it's like, I do that. But it's a combination of like, I'm still doing work. I'm still coming up with ideas, but I just like always get blocked at like the early stages of the video. So it's not like I'm doing absolutely nothing. It's just like the ideas that I'm coming up with, I'm just not like excited about them. Because the videos that do really well for me are ones where I come up with an idea, I'm super excited about it. And it's just like, I don't want to do anything until it's done. Even if it's, you know, a fair few days that it takes me to put it together. So I need to get better at just like pushing through, even if I'm not super excited about the idea. I think that's like my biggest problem. But yeah, you're right. That's my channel. If you look at my chart, it's like big spike. And then where's Hamish? Is he going to post? Is he going to post this week? He must post next week. Is he going to post the week after that?
No, it's so funny. So true.
Yeah.
I guess the one thing that I mean, I would be the same because you see the massive bump on analytics and you're like, oh, It's all good. I think that's like half of YouTube is just like, it's just like saving yourself. Just like, quick, bump the stats up again. And then when your stats are back up again, you're like, oh, thank goodness.
Yeah.
But I think the one thing that has helped me kind of combat your issue is having the boys here editing. Because I know, I'm like, I'm someone that, you know, if I'm spending money, I'm like, what am I getting for it? Like what I'm watching the dollars. And if these boys don't have something to edit, then they're still getting paid.
Yeah.
But I have to pay them, but they've got nothing to edit. So it forces me to like do the next video, which is good because it means we have a much more consistent content schedule, which is good for YouTube. But I definitely get what you mean. And especially when the other thing that gets me is when something happens suddenly that you want to make a video on and you're like, oh, quick news, and you jump on it and you spend, you know, it's maybe not the craziest, most in-depth video you could have made, but you want to talk about something and you maybe make the video across the next 5 hours and you put it up and it does really, really well. And then the one that you slave over for 4 weeks and you make it absolutely perfect and it just flops.
Yeah.
They're the ones that get me.
Yeah, there's just so many elements like that are involved, and it's crazy how much a good idea can carry a video that might not be as produced as other videos. Like it's crazy how much if something is really desired to be watched and you package it well, even if you spend maybe 3/4 of the time on it versus something else, it can just do so much better. But then the other thing is also true. Like you need to keep people engaged. So if you can kind of, when you hit those two things together, a good idea and it's well produced, it's just beautiful. It's a good thing.
It's like, oh,
yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Hamish, I was looking through the news of the week.
Yeah.
And I have to say, sometimes we talk about dry weeks.
I think within like the space of 2 minutes, we both messaged each other being like, there's nothing on here. I messaged you. I didn't even see your message yet. And I was like, this week is dry. But when it's dry, you can always find a crazy case of fraud somewhere. And I found one. whether it's a meat deli in New Jersey or some other fraud that we've spoken about, I found one. So I've got a crazy stock market fraud news story that happened just over the last week. So we'll talk about that. And there actually are a couple of other little tidbits here and there.
But, we did some digging. I'm going to talk about the US Consumer Confidence Report, which is kind of like an interesting survey. It's nothing like, it's not like inflation statistics or anything like that. It's actually just what do US consumers think,
right?
Which is kind of interesting. So breaking down the psychology of that.
Yeah.
I've also got, we'll talk about, oh, we need to talk about this Mitch McConnell stuff. He just, he had a big blunder again in the that was on Wednesday, so we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
What else are you covering today?
We've got Australian inflation and also another IPO. So the IPO market is in fact very much heating up, and this one's a big one. So we'll talk about that a little bit later in the podcast. But with that said, today's episode is brought to you by Seeking Alpha, your one-stop shop for stock analysis, market data, and news. Access expert analysis and news for thousands of stocks. View buy, hold, and sell ratings from members, Wall Street analysts, and Seeking Alpha's own algorithm. Screen for stocks using a variety of fundamental and technical analysis metrics. Access 10 years of financial data and company filings. And manage your portfolio by tracking your investments with price alerts so you never miss a buying opportunity again. Excuse me. Click the link in the episode description or head directly to seekingalpha.me/younginvestors to try Seeking Alpha free for 14 days. And just that a special deal from Seeking Alpha that just started a couple of days ago, I believe. For the next couple of weeks, you can get a $50 off coupon off your yearly subscription when you sign up using our link. So that's seekingalpha.me/younginvestors. They actually didn't tell me how long they're going to do this promotion for. They just said a couple of weeks. So, if you're interested, jump on it. Hopefully you guys enjoy that deal.
Yep. Little carrot. So definitely jump on. If you're on the fence, then, now's the time. You get $50 off. It's pretty handy.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Okay, Hamish. I want to talk to you about this Mitch McConnell stuff.
Yes.
This is really interesting. Did you see the first one? The first incident?
Yeah. So I saw the first one. So I don't know what he was actually talking about, but I'm thinking about the same thing. He stood up on stage and was talking about something, and he just kind of froze up, and someone had to kind of come and like take him away.
Totally froze up. Couldn't talk. Was kind of stuck in a loop. Had to be kind of taken away, and the press conference was done. I can't quite remember. I think later on they said, "Oh yeah, saw his physician. No worries. He's back at it," and he was back at it.
Right.
And then it happened again on Wednesday.
Oh.
So the same thing, which is definitely concerning. And I hope he's doing all right. Like regardless of your political biases.
Of course.
Hope he's doing all right, but. In a press conference on Wednesday, the Senate minority leader had another freezing episode. He was asked about running for re-election, and he struggled to hear the question, asked if they could repeat it multiple times, and then he froze up for about 30 seconds. A member of his staff then approached to help out, and he was pretty unresponsive, even when she asked if he had heard the question.
Wow.
Of course, we know that McConnell suffered a similar episode on July 26th in Washington, where he froze and was briefly unable to speak at a news conference. Mitch McConnell is 81 years old, and unfortunately, it again sparks the debate of, whether there needs to be better medical oversight on who is allowed to hold a position of political power in the United States.
Yeah. It is odd to see, because often these kind of events happen and then, people talk about it a bit, but then they just continue on with their work. It's not like they take any leave. As far as I can tell, I haven't noticed, Joe Biden, for example, he's had a number of stumbles and messing up his sentences, but I've never really noticed. Maybe he does take leave. I'm actually not sure. But normally there would be a pretty clear assessment, especially for a job that's very, very important. Like if you were the CEO of a company, for example, like the board would be all over that in a very, very serious way. And, it is more important, the people running the country. So there should be some significant, yeah, something there. I don't know. It's strange to see because it's not just Mitch McConnell. It's, yeah, as I said, it's Joe Biden and then
Joe Biden as well.
Donald Trump had his fair share of things as well. So it's it's happening quite frequently where these important people, potentially having an inability to do their job at times.
Yeah, absolutely. Joe Biden is 80 years old now, and here's the classic example. I'm not a political person. I don't have strong political biases one way or another. But it is like, another thing I should add is that we're also not American. So it actually, whatever we might think about US politics actually doesn't matter. It's not like we have a say in the matter. We're sitting over here in Australia. Yeah. But from my just perspective as, you know, a critical thinker, it is a bit concerning, I think, to see, like, Joe Biden is the classic example. He definitely has moments where, like I said, no matter what you think about US politics, he's really struggling with his cognition.
Yeah.
And it goes beyond just, like, we laugh at some of the memes where he just reads things wrong off a teleprompter. I mean, that can happen to anyone. Hell, I've read things wrong off a teleprompter many, many times. It does get worrying where you can see it's not just a simple mistake. It's really a cognitive error,
A pattern of errors for as well. A pattern of errors as well.
Is becoming a pattern with Mitch McConnell just freezing up and really not, you know, not being himself.
Yeah.
Joe Biden having countless kind of errors where he just can't seem to work his way through even simple cognitive tasks. Like, unfortunately, that's just the reality.
Yeah.
It's very simple stuff. Like, so simple that we look at it and we can identify what he's trying to say or what he's trying to do. And the fact that he can't do it is quite concerning.
And it's sad to see it get kind of politicized as well because, you know, the same people who, when, not to get too political, but the same people who, when Trump was in office, were really pushing hard to say he was incompetent, mentally incompetent, basically. Maybe he should even be impeached based on that. The same people who are in office now, like, kind of like willfully blind to Joe Biden. I'm not saying one was worse than the other or making any statement even like that, but you'd have to be crazy to be pushing so hard on one person and then to see Joe Biden and just not be pushing this. So it's so obvious that, and it makes sense. I mean, it's their political leader, so they're not going to, I guess that's just how the game works. But it's kind of sad to see that people just kind of go along these party lines and don't, like, view it objectively or just, like, kind of, like, I don't know, view it as the reality of what's happening.
So I read a stat from this article here. With the median age of 59 years old, the House and the Senate are older today than at any point in modern history.
Wow.
Yeah, so crazy. Pretty crazy. So, it definitely brings up the question of whether there should be some sort of, you know, age cap. Personally, I'm not in the boat that there needs to be an age cap. I don't think there should be age caps to anything in either direction. I don't think, you know, besides perhaps being over the age of 18, being an adult for some things. Like, I don't think there should be, you shouldn't be allowed to be the president if you're 28 or if you're 35 or if you're 60, 70, even 80 years old. I don't think there should be an age restriction. But I think that there is a solid argument that there does probably need to be more rigorous cognitive testing of people that hold positions of power. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm probably with you as well. I don't think there has to be kind of an age limit. I mean, there's plenty of people who are well into their 80s and are extremely competent.
Sharp.
I mean, a lot of the investors that we look up to are in their 80s and 90s and are extremely sharp. So I don't think age is. And then there's, you know, people who will they'll be less sharp by 70 or even, you know, late 60s or something. Right? So it's different for each person. So you're right. I think it just needs to be a testing process. I don't think it's an age block off. It's kind of the same way I feel about driving. Like, I feel like once you get to a certain age, maybe you should have to do like a test every couple of years or something just to make sure you've still got it. I don't think you should be banned from driving when you reach a certain age, but potentially, like, you should, you know, go through some sort of testing just to make sure you can still do it. I think the same thing probably applies to this.
Yeah, definitely. What else have I got? Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, who at 90 is the oldest member of either party in Congress, has come under immense bipartisan scrutiny for continuing to hold her Senate seat despite a series of debilitating health issues. Feinstein was away from Washington for 3 months earlier this year while she recovered from shingles, leaving Democrats down a vote in the Senate, where members are not permitted to cast votes when absent.
Right.
So there you go. So there is, like, if it gets, obviously, I feel for this senator, but, you know, if it gets bad enough where they are absent, it actually can have an adverse effect on their political party. So,
yeah.
It's an interesting debate.
Wow.
It's an interesting debate.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess we'll see. Like, obviously, I hope Mitch McConnell makes a good recovery. But yeah, it definitely raises those questions again. What needs to be done? Because it's kind of crazy. Like, when you see the leader of the United States talking and you're like, wow, like, I can speak better than this guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you see that happening, then you're like, oof, geez, it's not a great look. And, yeah, there's an argument, I guess, as well, where the president is just like the captain of a very large ship that has a very small rudder. So it probably doesn't actually matter that much.
Yeah.
But they tend to be more of a spokesperson than anything.
Yeah.
But yeah.
You need someone on the off chance that some critical decision comes down, something really big, whether it's to participate in a war or something like that. And you need somebody, even those decisions, they're probably still getting advised.
No, they're definitely but massive advisory
of
panels
course,
on it.
But you still hope, I guess, that you've got someone with a strong grounding in rationale to make, you know, or to take on that advice and not to just be like, okay, yes, but like to actually be able to critically think about important decisions. But maybe that's asking too much. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe it is. Who knows?
All right. Let's,
America can be described in a single word, Hamish. All right, moving on.
Yeah, let's talk let's talk about the IPO market because... Okay. What did we have? We had one fairly recently. Was it that Vietnamese auto company?
Yeah,
was that
EV
company.
Yeah.
Were they listing in the US or was that an American?
I think so.
Listing?
I think was that the SPAC, the one that got
that was a SPAC.
Brought onto
That's
them?
Right.
Yeah, through a SPAC.
I was going to say, because this was reported by CNBC, this IPO, as the first significant VC-backed IPO since December 2021. So that makes sense because what we spoke about a couple of weeks ago was not technically an IPO. They did a special purpose acquisition company, which is kind of a secret backdoor.
Roundabout way.
It's a roundabout way for companies to go public. But the traditional way is to do an initial public offering. And the company doing so later this year is Instacart. So Instacart's a kind of a grocery delivery and pickup service in the US. It was founded in 2012. And it's kind of like Uber Eats, but just focusing on kind of grocery stores, essentially, pickup delivery from grocery and convenience stores. So the tech delivery company is set to IPO on the NASDAQ in September. It was announced this week. It's an interesting company because a lot of the time you get really early stage companies IPOing and they are relatively young, but they're 11 years old. And they actually have a reasonable business behind them.
In
2022, they generated $2.55 billion of revenue, which is small in the scheme of the market. So the Uber, by comparison, did $32 billion in 2022. So they're quite a bit smaller than Uber, but they're a reasonable size. They have 7 million monthly active orders that come from 5,500 participating stores. And they essentially just make money the same way most of these kind of apps make money. They take a percentage of sales from grocery stores. But unique to Instacart in some ways is they actually have a really strong in-app advertising business, which Uber and these other businesses do have in-app advertising for stores to get their shops to kind of the top of the search results. But Instacart in particular has a very strong one. They have $406 million of ad revenue in the first half of this year. So they actually have a big advertising business. $406 million in a half year is kind of crazy.
Wow. Yeah. So how do they run it? So is it like kind of a Google search functionality where businesses pay to be at the top, or is it actually advertising?
Yeah, exactly. It's just paid search results. They might have other types of advertising. I haven't I don't use the app. It's only in the US and Canada, so I don't know what kinds of ads they serve specifically. Yeah, that's kind of the main type of ad that these apps have, which is just allow you to get to the top, because there are so many restaurants on these apps now. It can be hard to get noticed. Yeah. It's interesting. It's kind of a new dynamic, in the same way that Google search was this new dynamic, where like in the early days, there wasn't actually that many. It was kind of easy to get your store or your website to the top naturally. Now there's so much competition that you maybe want to pay to get advertising on search. So it's a natural component of these businesses, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, interesting.
And it's actually profitable as well, which is, you know.
Let's just back that up a second.
Yeah.
You're telling me, sitting here on the 31st of August, 2023, that an IPO is a profitable business?
Actually makes money.
Well, let me tell you. This IPO is going to flop.
People don't want it. People don't want this.
They don't want it. They don't want reputable businesses that make money. No.
Yeah, no. No, so yeah, they're actually profitable, which is surprising, because even Uber Eats isn't profitable as a segment of Uber's business. But they've been profitable for 5 straight quarters, and last quarter was $114 million. So there you go. They're making a little bit of money. When we compare that to their private valuation, things get a little bit wonky, which they tend to do, unfortunately, with IPOs. Yeah. Even if they do produce a bit of profits, generally the market is very, very, venture capital investors are usually very willing to pay extreme multiples, extremely high prices for some of these businesses.
Yeah. Tell me about it. What was the valuation in the end?
Yeah. So, well, we don't know. So in terms of public valuation, we don't know yet, because they're going to go public in September, and we actually don't really have any details at all yet. So we don't have an expected valuation, but I can give you some of the private valuations. So they've obviously raised capital while private. So they don't get a constant stock update when they're private, of course, but every time someone invests, they pay a certain amount for a certain percentage, and therefore we can calculate what the latest value is essentially for the company.
Yeah.
So in 2021, and this is when venture capital was just thriving. There was all kinds of crazy stuff going on in 2021. The company was valued privately at $39 billion.
So, wow.
And that's back at a time when they were not profitable. And I would imagine revenue was quite a bit smaller. So they used to be valued $39 billion. In March of 2022, it was slashed to $24 billion. So started to cool off, and investors started to get a little bit more realistic about maybe what this company's valued at. A couple months later, towards the end of 2022, it was slashed another 50% to $12 billion. And that's where we're at. So
this is proving my thesis, Hamish.
What's your thesis?
So what you're telling me is that as the company's financials have improved over time, investors now think that the company is worth less.
Yeah.
Told you.
Yeah.
Told you. This is classic. This is classic, you know. What's the management team doing? If they're going to IPO, in fact, maybe they can, I'm sure they can spend some more money, maybe do, I don't know. They just need to spend a lot of money to get rid of that profit so that when they IPO, they can raise more.
They need to do marketing. They need to spend $2. They spend $2 on $2 for every $2 of marketing, get $1 in revenue. And that means, you know, every time they do that, they're losing a dollar, but their revenue will be higher, their growth will be faster, and their valuation will be higher. And then they get more money that they can spend on marketing. And it's definitely not a Ponzi scheme, because then that creates more growth with less profitability, and then they raise more money and then they put it into It's not a Ponzi scheme. It's real. It's just
Hamish, genius. Yeah. So if you're the CEO of this company, what was it called? Instacart. If you want us to come on as head of marketing, just call us up. No, this is crazy. Well, it is kind of like, of course, we're having a joke, but it is kind of funny how so many IPOs the last few years have just been I won't go so far to say rubbish companies, but companies that are certainly not making any money.
Yeah. Well, just a lot of unproven money going, an enormous amount of money going into unproven business models, a disproportionate amount going that really shouldn't be there.
And like, you should be like, oh, okay, cool, whatever. You know, it's actually like an unfathomable amount of money going into these like unprofitable businesses over the last few years. Yeah. So,
Crazy. And it's funny kind of talking about marketing because you might be wondering if they're profitable, why go public, right? Like, you know, a lot of companies, they go public to raise capital, to raise an enormous amount of money. That's what an IPO is, initial public offering. They're offering stock to the public for the first time, raise a bunch of money, and they can use that to grow. So why do it? And one, you know, probably a core reason is they can still raise more capital and use that to fund faster growth. And it also allows them over time to then access more funding, right? It's not just the initial public offering. Companies can then raise capital later from the public markets. But it's also likely, and this was kind of speculated by the Business Insider article I was reading, that a lot of companies, even if they're profitable and they don't really need outside capital, they'll go public because it gives kind of a consistent stream of publicity that just helps to drive more people to use the app. So more people are talking about public companies because you have these kind of quarterly filings coming out every quarter. So people are talking about the business. So it's just more free marketing that businesses tend to have. And that's ultimately, I'm sure, plays a role in why most of the, well, not most, like, pretty much all the biggest companies in the world are public. There are exceptions to that, but certainly most big companies.
Yeah, probably a bit of like perceived credibility, I guess. Exactly. Do you use Instacart? They're like a public company now, right? Yeah. They're like listed on the on the NASDAQ. You know.
Yeah. So there you go. That's pretty much it. So yeah, I think later in the year, well, we're kind of close to September now, but we'll as we get closer to the date, we'll get some estimates of where they think they'll go public. I'm pretty sure they didn't even release yet how much they expect to raise or anything like that either. So we'll find out a bit more about that next month, and then we can talk about it. It'll probably go up a bunch on IPO, and then we can slowly watch it decline 90% like every other IPO.
Buy in and then short.
Yeah, exactly.
I wonder if you buy in, make your money, get out and short. I wonder if you applied that to every IPO over the last, like, I don't know, 4 years, how much money you'd make.
Yeah, anyway. Well, it's funny because it's so volatile, right? Like, I think 2021, everything just surged, right? Like, I don't think there was a stock, an IPO that had a bad first couple of days in 2021. Yeah. Like, it was just up 100%, up 40%. But then, more recently, we've just seen that absolutely decimated. So it is funny.
I was going to say, you take all the IPOs, US IPOs that have happened since 2019, and you apply the strategy, buy on day one, hold for, 3 months. Let's say hold for 3 months, and then sell, and then short. and then hold you short. I wonder, like, what sort of return you'd come out with.
Yeah, I think you've done pretty well. The only thing is, if you're shorting something and then it actually rockets, you're gone. Yeah. The whole portfolio is decimated, which obviously does happen.
Very true. Interesting. Okay, another IPO to watch. Oh, get excited, everybody.
We love them.
One thing. Have I told you my Uber One experience? Have I told this story on the podcast?
No,
already?
I don't think so.
I figured out why Uber makes no money.
Because Uber One is just way too good.
Have you used it before?
Yeah.
Do you have it now?
I don't have it now, but it's an insane deal if you're using it like a reasonable amount. Like, it's just crazy how much they must be losing on that. But what's your experience with it specifically? Like, groceries and that sort of thing?
So Uber One is this monthly subscription service for Uber, right? Costs $10 a month here in Australia. And then when I don't use it for rides. I just drive around Canberra. I'm not traveling that much at the moment. I use it for Uber Eats. And every day it seems they're spitting new deals at you. But the deals are actually really good. Like, I looked on the weekend and one of the deals I had was spend $50 on groceries and spend 30, so save $20. So I was just like to mum, hey mum, do you have any groceries that you want me to get delivered to? And so we loaded up the cart with $50 worth of groceries. We checked the prices of the goods as well, make sure they weren't just like overpriced to make up for the difference. But sure enough, they were fairly priced. Got $50 worth of groceries and got it delivered for $30.
Yeah.
It's pretty good. The other day, I was sitting here late in the office with JJ, and we're just looking at the deals, and I got like two big things and noodles, like big things and noodles from Wok It Up. And It costs. JJ, what did the noodles cost in the end? Did I say it was like $20? I was like, it wasn't. Yeah, it was dirt cheap. It was just amazing.
Yeah, it's like if you're ordering on Uber Eats, it's like normally pretty expensive. But especially if you're getting, but if you're going to do it like once a week anyway, like you're probably saving like $6-$7 on delivery now if you get Uber One. And if you do that every week for a month, then Uber is just in the red. Like they're just losing on you. Like sure, you shouldn't be ordering Uber Eats all the time. But from their perspective, they're getting $10 instead of $5 every time you order something on a delivery. Well, they're not getting it. It's a delivery fee, but they still have to make that up themselves. So it makes no sense. It makes perfect sense that they're losing a ton of money on Uber Eats. And I don't know how that even I just don't get how that works. Like, I don't get how their math works. I guess they would need a lot of people to have Uber One but not use it to make up for the people who use Uber Eats a lot, and they're clearly losing money on those people. So that's the math, I guess. Can those people subsidize the heavy users? But I don't know. It just doesn't seem like it makes any sense considering how much it costs every time to just for delivery fees and that sort of thing. It's
Here's another one. I got two big chicken burgers, right?
Yeah.
Two big chicken burgers with a small thing of chips, okay, each. That was for myself and Claude. And it was delivered to me here in the office. Mm. And guess how much that cost me overall?
I don't know. Was it two meals? It's probably normally two
big chicken burgers and a side of chips.
40?
it cost me $5.59.
That's crazy. That's insane.
But I wonder why Uber's not making any money. Yeah. Oh, that's why.
I've been saying this for ages. Uber Eats is a terrible business. Yeah. It's a terrible business. The economics are just bad. There's just too many people that need to get paid. Uber, the driver, the restaurant. There's too many people that need to get paid for what people are willing to
for
pay.
For what it is.
For what it is. Yeah. Like cold food.
Yeah, for the low total that you're dealing with. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
yeah. Very interesting. Anyway, another one I found was DoorDash. I got two chicken burgers from Red Rooster the other day for $2.
Mm.
So that's some good deals.
Yeah, you know
what?
We used to have Deliveroo in Australia. It's like a UK-based delivery company, and they had free delivery for a while. So I was using that for ages, and then they went bankrupt. So.
It was you, Hamish. It was you.
Yeah, like, this guy's got to slow down. He's actually speeding up.
On every quarterly earnings call, they had to talk about you.
Yeah.
The analyst would come on and be like, can we just get an update on Hamish Hodder?
On client X. Like, he's running 400 million in losses.
He's ordering food for the whole of Australia every single day.
How can one man eat this much? That's really funny.
Oh dear. Anyway, that's a little sidetrack. So yes, Instacart, everybody.
Yeah. take us through this US consumer confidence report. I'm curious to see. So is it kind of like a survey of households of sorts?
Yes, it's just like a survey. It's just a survey of consumers, and they just ask them questions. What do you think about X? What do you think about Y?
Yep.
And so it's not actually grounded in hard economic data.
Yep.
It is exactly as the name suggests. It is a confidence survey. So it says here, the consumer confidence survey reflects prevailing business conditions and likely developments for the months ahead. This monthly report details consumer attitudes, buying intentions, vacation plans, and consumer expectations for inflation, stock prices, and interest rates. So, the Conference Board Consumer Confidence Index declined in August to a value of 106.1 from a downwardly revised 114 in July. So, what does that mean for context? So, it's at 106 right now. For context, in the first half of 2020, coronavirus, stock market falling, the index fell to around 85.
Right.
And during the stimulus-fueled excitement of 2021, it rose to about 130. So you got 85 low and 130 on the high end.
Yeah.
And right now, we're just declining a little bit down to 106 from 114.
Yeah.
overall, we've seen a downward trend since 2021 when it was high, obviously. But across the last 12 months or so, we have seen things been stabilizing, coming back up. So that's what the trend has been looking like. So it's interesting that that this month we've seen a bit of a decline.
That's that's some helpful context to give us kind of a band of like where the number normally sits. Because I guess, first half of 2021, 85, that's probably as maybe as low as you're going to see it over the next decade.
First half of 2020.
I mean, unless we, first half of 2020, So that's kind of as, I would imagine as bad as, I'd be interested to see how bad it got in like 2008. But I would imagine that's kind of the lot of, it was pretty bad for consumer confidence during that time. So, but it's interesting to see that there's still, it's still like quite above, kind of the middle part of, that, range you gave us.
Interesting. It's, and it has been helped out a lot in the last 12 months or so. It's bounced out up quite significantly. I guess that makes sense. It's all the stock market's gone up as well and all sorts of things.
Yeah.
Consumer confidence fell in August 2023, erasing back-to-back increases in June and July, said Dana Peterson, chief economist at the Conference Board. August's disappointing headline number reflected dips in both the current conditions and expectations indexes. So it also asked them about expectations of the future. Write-in responses showed that consumers were once again preoccupied with rising prices in general and for groceries and gasoline in particular. The pullback in consumer confidence was evident across all age groups and most notable among consumers with household incomes of $100,000 or more, as well as those earning less than $50,000. Confidence held relatively steady for consumers with incomes between those two numbers.
Wow.
So we've also got some interesting stats on the present situation, what's happening right now, and then also people's expectations of the future. So I just wanted to run through a few of them that they quote. So consumers' assessment of current business conditions was slightly less positive in August. You have 20.7% of consumers said that business conditions were good, and 17.2% said business conditions were bad. So that's quite interesting. Consumers' appraisal of the labor market deteriorated in August. So 40.3% of consumers said that jobs were plentiful, which is down from 43% in July. And then 14.1% of consumers said jobs were hard to get, up from 11.3%.
Wow, yeah. So that still leans...
A little bit of a change in the labor market.
Yeah, it still leans very heavy towards being a kind of a hot labor market, but trending in somewhat of a more normal direction, I would imagine.
Yeah, it's a stark difference when you see like 20% said that business conditions are good, 17% said they were bad, and then you get 40% of people saying, yeah, jobs are plentiful. So it's a bigger difference. Let's talk about, expectations 6 months hence.
Yeah.
So consumers were less optimistic about the short-term business conditions short-term business conditions outlook in August. 16.2% of consumers expect business conditions to improve, down from 17.2% in July. Meanwhile, 16.8% expect business conditions to worsen, up from 14.5%. Consumers' short-term income prospects worsened in August. So 16.5% of consumers expect their incomes to increase, down from 17.8% in July. And 12.4% expect their incomes will decrease, which is up from 9.9%. So a little bit of a jump there as well.
Interesting.
Yeah. Consumers' perceived likelihood of a US recession over the next 12 months ticked down in August to its lowest, to the lowest level recorded thus far in 2023.
Right.
So 69% voted either very likely or somewhat likely for a US recession over the next 12 months versus 71% last month. The highest was 73% back in May.
That's still crazy. That's an insane percentage. 70% think there's going to be a recession. That's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if I don't know what bias this would be.
Yeah.
But I wonder if it's kind of like if you came out of the blue and said, hey, I just wanted to ask you a question. What do you think the likelihood of a US recession is in the next 12 months? Is that kind of a bias where it sounds as though it's a preloaded question?
Mm.
Like, why are they asking me about whether there's going to be a recession in the next 12 months?
Yeah.
Is there going to be a recession in the next 12 months?
Yeah.
I guess so. Yeah. I'm not sure what bias that might be, but the way you phrase a question can almost load it, I guess.
Yeah. I don't know. I would have to look at, you know, you'd have to kind of see how they structured it, whether they have ways to deal with that. They ask some people a certain way and other people a different way, and then they kind of compare results to kind of remove those biases. I'm sure they have some things in mechanisms in place to reduce biases.
The only other one to get specifically to that question would be, what do you think that the US won't be in a recession in the next 12 months? But then that's almost even more of a loaded question.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I don't want to seem like a dummy if I say no.
That's true. It's kind of tricky how to ask that question.
I don't know. If you're someone that designs scientific studies or surveys for a living, definitely let us know the way around to these kind of biases, because it does seem like, I don't know, personally, if I was on the street and someone said, what do you think the likelihood is that, do you think it's likely that the US will be in a recession next year? I would probably, my own mental bias, if I didn't know any better, would probably be like, I guess so.
Yes, probably just be no, like, yeah.
There must be a reason they're asking me about US recessions, right?
Mm.
You know?
Yeah, it's an interesting point. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, anyway. Always love the Daily Upside for a bit of humor added to it, added to the article. He said, but sentiment means diddly squat compared to actual spending. True, I guess. Even if it's increasingly going towards experiences over goods. Experiences like, say, a trip to the Amalfi Coast. In addition to nearly half of consumers expecting to travel in the next year, roughly 20% of consumers say their trips will be abroad. It's the highest ever share, according to data going back to the 1970s. So people, they're struggling, but they're still packing up and going for an overseas holiday.
Yeah, I think we were talking about this last week, how like the Qantas record earnings, demand for travel in Australia is off the charts, and it is kind of interesting. It's like you have these two conflicting views. It's like cost of living crisis and people struggling with all of these things, and then you see, you know, companies like Qantas just posting record numbers. And you know, obviously there's you know, different breakdowns of different people and how they're handling the cost of living crisis, but there is a distinct kind of conflict of data that we're seeing. At least some portion of people in Australia and the US are at least not fazed too much about what's happening and are just continuing to spend, maybe even more than they normally would coming out of COVID. I don't know, you know, what percentage of the population that is, but yeah, it seems like it's a substantial proportion at least. And travel, it seems to be one of those like big areas. Yeah.
Yeah. Hamish, you have segued that perfectly for me into this last point. Yeah, you did. It says here from the article, that dovetails with two major industries tied to tourism, airlines and hotels, which have both largely rebounded from pandemic lulls. A Reuters analysis published earlier this summer of key hotel metrics in 15 major metro US areas shows the industry has almost entirely recovered, while airlines have expanded international routes to keep pace with US demand, driven in part by a strong dollar. So you are absolutely correct, Hamish.
There you go. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a,
but they, yeah, I don't have too much to add on this. it is a dry week in the news, but interesting to have a look at what people think as well as what's actually happening, just what people think about some of these different economic conundrums, situations. I don't know how you say it.
I mean, it can also be the case that people are struggling more, but I think often, like, if people just have more in their savings accounts, maybe it's built up from COVID or something, they're more likely to drain those before they actually cut back. Like, people were very hesitant to cut back their lifestyle. Like, they'll prefer to drain their savings before they start to cut back. So we're potentially just seeing a lag as well in that people are experiencing, you know, the cost of living crisis, but are kind of slow to make those adjustments, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, makes sense. They cut back once they've got no more money.
Yeah, pretty much.
They cut back because they've got no more money.
Exactly. Yeah. All right.
All right, Hamish, tell me about something.
Yeah, let's. What you got? I found, as I said, I promised at the beginning, I found an interesting case of fraud, which is always always fun to talk about, and it's a doozy. It's a doozy. So
it's a doozy.
Yeah. This is a story of a fast food worker who tricked his broker into giving him hundreds of thousands of dollars to trade.
What?
So it's a really interesting story. Wow. And it's kind of crazy because the type of thing that he did, I'm sure he didn't think about it too much, but it's actually a particular scheme that is a fairly regular occurrence with the SEC that they actually have to kind of defend against. So
does it start with a P or is it a different scheme?
It's not a Ponzi scheme. It is a different scheme.
It is a different scheme. Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Here we go.
So 23-year-old Dayton Anthony was a part-time worker at Auntie Annie's pretzel shop. And essentially, in July, he applied for a brokerage account. And they didn't actually list who the broker was. I guess maybe for privacy reasons or something. But he applied for a brokerage account. And this is where his first fraud began. On the application, he said he earned...
The first one?
There's a couple of moments of fraud.
Oh, my gosh. All right.
So on the application, he said he earned $25,000 to $50,000 a year, when in reality, he made $400 a month. Not an egregious lie, I guess. I mean, he didn't say he was making $500,000 a year, but you can't lie. You can't lie. You can't lie on the brokerage application, because they, of course, use that to determine, you know, how much margin maybe you're able to access and other sorts of capital. So after doing that, he went on to link his bank account to his trading account, as you would. Although his bank account at the time only had 9 cents in it. So might make you start to think, what was this guy planning? Like how is he planning on it trading with 9 cents in his account? It's just very little money in his account. But what he did, which was, as I was kind of alluding to, is this kind of a scheme called a free riding scheme, is he was able to initiate a deposit of $1 million from his bank to the broker. And obviously this deposit would fail because he doesn't have any money in his account. But he was able to initiate the deposit. So from the broker, he was able to basically pull money attempt to pull money out of his bank account, and he attempted to do it. And of course, it would fail, but it would take a day or so for the broker to go through the process and check and confirm the transaction before it would ultimately fail. And this is where the broker, how the broker functions kind of broke down. While the deposit was pending, the broker gave Anthony $200,000 in credit. So they essentially assumed that this would go through. They kind of had his false income and this $1 million pending transaction or pending deposit. And because of those things, they ended up giving him $200,000 in credit immediately, which they definitely shouldn't have done.
He took
that money and immediately used it to invest in 8 stocks. And do you want to have a guess at what kind of this kind of person, what kind of stocks they might be interested in?
Oh, gosh. It's got to be if it's stocks, I would have said he'd dump it in Bitcoin or something. But no, if it's stocks, it would have been just meme stocks or something.
Give me a stock.
GameStop.
GameStop. He invested $78,000 into GameStop. You got any other guesses?
AMC.
He invested $13,000 into AMC.
Oh my gosh.
He did $85,000 into Apple. Which is, you know, that's actually not a bad choice.
He's following Warren Buffett, mate.
He's a prodigy. $22,000 into Nvidia, $700 into Tesla, and then $800 into Cano Health, EA, and a bunch of other stocks as well.
Right. Okay. Wow, that's crazy.
So
that is insane.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of surprised reading this, because I didn't know that brokers would even do that they would even give credit up front, just assuming that you've been telling the truth on your application. I mean, as I said, he had 9 cents in his account, so there was no actual money at all. He didn't deposit any of his real money initially, and that kind of gave some credibility or anything like that. It was just a brand new account, 23 years old, lied on the application about his income and the deposit.
They've given him a $199,999.91 loan.
Yeah. What's that leverage? What leverage is that? That's an insane leverage ratio, like 10,000. 10,000x margin leverage.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Of course, the next day, the deposit attempt failed, as you would expect.
You're kidding.
Yes, shock horror. They went to look in the vault. They pulled open the vault, expecting to see millions of dollars. And it was just a dusty floor with some cobwebs and 9 pennies. the guy just like, dude, I just like to imagine an actual person like opening the vault and be like, what have we done?
it's like the plot twist in a movie, you know? It was like Ocean's 11 when the bad guy goes to open his vault and there's like nothing in there, just like 9 pennies and a note or something.
Yeah.
And he's like, and that's the moment where the music plays and he's like, oh no. And then George Clooney is like on a yacht being like, oh, I did it.
So true. Oh, man. The deposit failed. The broker immediately froze his account and liquidated the holdings, as you would expect. The funny thing is his investments for the one day that he had them were actually positive, but he was, of course, not allowed to keep any of the profits because they were earned fraudulently. Ooh. So, yeah. Sad news for him,
boo.
Which is kind of funny because in the end it means the broker made about $7,000 in profit from allowing this to happen.
From this guy.
Which now that I think about it, maybe that's why they allow that. Like
maybe they're looking for the Warren Buffett prodigies out there. Yeah, you know?
Exactly. They knew this guy was going to have a profitable trade. So they were like, you know what? Just let him do it. No.
I hope they at least like give him a plaque in their head office or something. Yeah. Like, come on. $7,000, you can dedicate the Daytona Anthony Hall.
He gets his own hall, does he?
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
He gets a hall.
Oh, man. So
he gets a memorial bench.
Yeah, you can get a bench out the front. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, in the park.
So in total, he made, well, he didn't make, the broker made $4,700 on GameStop and $1,600 on Apple and $800 on Nvidia. So
nice.
Good job to whoever let that application go through. 2 days.
Yeah, they should get a bonus.
Yeah, they shouldn't be fired at all for allowing that to happen.
They should get a cut of the profit, I'd say.
Yeah, exactly right. 2 days later, he was also fired from his job for not showing up. I don't know if that was actually related to this. I guess maybe it was, but
wait, Mr. Anthony was.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh no.
Yeah, he was fired. Maybe he thought he'd struck it big and he didn't show up to work.
Maybe.
Yeah. And then, of course, he was investigated by the SEC. No surprise to anyone. The SEC said, when asked why he made the $1 million unfunded deposit without having funds to cover the transaction, Anthony excused his conduct as a joke, and he said that he never really thought of it as fraud. There you go. He kind of just... He kind of just... thought he could do it. And it kind of reminds me of all those people who were duplicating their money with that Robinhood era a while back. Mm. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
I think a lot of people didn't realize that they're actually just either committing fraud or or like they're going to have their credit scores absolutely obliterated because it's going to be on their permanent like thing. This isn't just some kind of like random app. Like this isn't, you know, this isn't like V-Bucks in like on a game or something.
Yeah, because I think a lot of them went into enormous amounts of debt on those brokerage sites. I can't remember. I think that was a big story because unfortunately one person commits suicide after being losing out so heavily trading with money that wasn't theirs.
Yeah, for context, for people wondering how that worked, basically Robinhood allowed people to have 2x margin, but every time you took on, which is kind of a loan, every time you took on a loan and put it in your account balance obviously went up and it used that number to figure out how much margin you could get. So you get put in 1,000 and then you get $1,000 in margin, so you have 2,000. And then they offer you another 2,000 in margin, so then now you have 4,000 and you could just do this. It was just an error in the app. But yeah, it led to some people taking on enormous amounts of debt that they definitely shouldn't have had. But yeah, as I said, this scheme actually has a name, even though it sounds like it's some stupid thing someone would just try and do.
Yeah.
And just it seems like that's what it was. He just thought it was like he just tried to deposit $1 million that he didn't have. Like he was just being an idiot, I guess. But it is a real scheme. It's called a free riding scheme. And the idea behind it and how it would actually work, not that anyone should attempt this, please. But you would make a false deposit, use the money to invest, and then get the money out and back into your account before the broker catches on and freezes your account. It's a genuine right. scheme that that people actually do, and the SEC actually investigates.
Right. So, interesting.
Yeah. There you go. I thought that was kind of funny. You go.
Yeah.
Crazy. It's been a while since we've had. I don't know. I feel like back in when Robin Hood was really kicking off, we had a lot of silly Wall Street bets. People just finding ridiculous little things, like doing insane options calls that just obliterated their portfolios. And this is kind of a window back into that.
It's quite funny, really.
Yeah.
Oh, those were the days, weren't they, Hamish?
Yeah. Maybe it'll come back. It's coming back. The IPO market is coming back.
It's coming back, mate. All right. Tell me quickly what's going on with the Australian inflation. Then we got to wrap up in a couple of minutes as well.
Oh, yeah. Nothing too crazy to talk about here. Headline inflation declined to 4.9% from 5.4% reported the month before. It's the lowest rate in 18 months. So,
woohoo!
Continues to get better and better and better. Core CPI or core inflation, which strips out the volatile components, was still worse, but did improve. It came in at 5.8%, down from 6.1%. So core inflation is still quite bad, 6%, but it is coming down. It's just coming down really, really slowly.
Less of a woohoo.
Less of a woohoo.
Mild, mild woohoo.
Yeah, 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 exactly.
In terms 6 out of 10 woohoo.
Six out of 10. In terms of the biggest contributors, housing increased 7.3% year over year, 5.9% from new dwellings, and 7.6% from rent. Same as last month. Food was up 5.6%. Electricity was up 15.7%. So electricity has been the big driver in the last month or so.
Wow.
Plus 6% in July alone, which is enormous.
Jeez. That's crazy. That's a massive spike in July.
Yeah, it's that's an enormous year-over-year rate if that, obviously, it's not going to continue. Huge rate.
Even still crazy, yeah.
Automotive fuel was down 7.6% year-over-year, so it's kind of risen a little bit recently, so that figure has kind of gotten a little bit worse, but year-over-year it's still down. And then fruit and veg down 5.4% year-over-year.
There you go. Interesting. Oh, I guess good headline coming down. That core inflation is still pretty high though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Not too much to say on this. Other than fingers crossed it keeps going down because things are expensive over here. The case all around the world, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you have anything to add?
Nah, that's just about it. Do we have time for some Q&As?
Yeah, let's do a couple questions. Let's do a couple questions. Right. Always like to do a couple Q&A questions.
Yeah, and as always.
Sorry. We both had the same idea at the same time.
We're always taking more questions. So if you have any, if you're on Spotify, just scroll up in the app and you're able to ask your questions natively in there, or you're welcome to head over to the YouTube version of the Young Investors podcast channel and just leave your questions as a comment on the latest episode. I'll ask this one to you. Where should I start for you? What
do
you
want me to say? I don't know. Do you want to this is a massive one at the start. Let's do the massive one because it's a wall of text and we always avoid it because it's such a wall of text.
Yeah, okay.
See how you go.
We haven't answered this before? No, I don't think we have.
I don't think so. Okay. No.
Hey guys, great podcast. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Greetings from Iceland here. That's cool.
Iceland.
Yeah. Have you been to Iceland?
Cool.
You haven't been anywhere besides the US.
I've not been to Europe.
No, I haven't been to Iceland. Yeah. It's definitely on my bucket list, that's for sure.
Yeah, it'd be awesome.
I'm interested in hearing your thoughts about investing in new companies, pre-profit and even pre-revenue. Now I'm not talking about tech unpredictable companies, but rather predictable companies with maybe estimated CapEx and an existing market. For example, a new mine that costs X millions to get up and running and can produce Y amount of copper or any other resource. Makes sense. Mm-hmm. You can use dollar cost average to value these opportunities.
Discounted cash flow
to value these opportunities. But how do you account for the extra risk of it being a new company and what I would call execution risk? I think that's the first question. Yeah.
So that it is obviously very, very true. You can use discounted cash flow just to evaluate the expected return of any, you know, companies do it to estimate the returns of their investments going forward. But and you can do it on a new company as well. And like, sure, that there are people that specialize in things like mining, and they can figure out like what grade of ore is coming out of the ground, how much it's going to take to get a mine up and running, how much they're going to be able to pull out based on the, you know, geography and that kind of stuff, and all of the different tests that they do. So, like, I'm not saying there's not money to be made there. I don't have the faintest idea of how to evaluate those kind of projects. I don't work in that area, that kind of stuff. I choose not to invest in very early stage companies. I have done in the past, and I just got burnt, and it's kind of left a bit of a scar. But it kind of taught me a lesson in that, you know, pre-revenue companies, companies that are pre-profit, that are new, that are, you know, just up and coming, they might hit it out the park. They might be the next Apple. But it's very hard to predict them, what their future cash flows are going to be. It's, for me anyway, it's very hard to see, to try and estimate what the future will be. And, you know, part of the Warren Buffett approach that I subscribe to is to find those opportunities where, you know, you can't be certain, but your predictions of the future are, you know, you're quite confident in them. Whereas I find that with these young companies, I just really can't get a good grip on them. Not saying that you know if you know heaps about copper mining or gold mining or whatever, and it's a new company, they're going to set up this, I know it's going to cost them X amount to set up this mine, they're going to be able to drag out hundreds of millions of dollars of ore or whatever. That's great if you can do it. I can't do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you want to be confident that the company is going to be thriving over time, it has to have some kind of moat. And a lot of the time, you're going to be able to identify that moat from a business that has a long track record of demonstrating that they have that moat. I'm not sure about this industry as well, but you know, maybe it's the case that you can identify a moat before the company's even launched. Maybe that is true. I don't know. Anything's possible. I've never seen it. Whether it comes to a brand or scale economics, generally there has to be, you know, especially with a brand. Brand is a good example of one where you can't invest in a company and say that it has a brand moat before it's launched, because a brand by definition it has been established usually for multiple decades. That's what a brand is. So that's like a good example of a moat that, it's maybe one way that you would identify a stable company. And you can't possibly invest in new companies just based off brand, simply by that. So that's what you would have to think through, is can I identify some kind of moat, some kind of intrinsic layer of protection? And personally, I've always looked for companies with, you know, 20 years or more even of track record before there's even really evidence that they have something that gives me confidence that the business will keep going forward.
Yeah, it's a good point. The more history you have to look back at and say, the more consistent that history presents to you, then that gives you the confidence to be able to model out into the future. But without that history, it becomes a bit of a juggle, like a bit of a guessing game. I'm not quite sure what's going to happen in the future. But hopefully that helps. Again, I don't want to like poo-poo the idea. You know, if you can do it, then that's awesome. But personally, I just don't kind of stray into that area.
You can ask me the second part of the question. I think it's actually a good question.
Okay, sure. Yeah, we'll finish up. Yeah, finish up after this one. So how do you plan for future dilution, which is not always a negative?
That's an interesting question. That's a good point. I think my answer to this would be that I don't think you really can. I think this is probably another reason why I don't like new companies and certainly unprofitable companies that need to dilute a lot, is it's very difficult to figure out what are your shares going to be worth at the end of the day. When the dust settles, how many shares are they going to be? What is my piece of the pie as a percentage of ownership in the company? I think that's really difficult. Yeah. So that's, again, why I generally like to look at companies that are a bit older, are not raising capital, so they're self-sustainable. So they're not raising capital anymore. They just run their own stuff. And they even have excess capital to distribute, which is just kind of, you know, cherry on top of the cake as well. But my answer is I don't know how to deal with dilution. If companies are always diluting, I can't value them because I don't know what my share is going to be worth at the end of the day when they stop.
Yeah, yeah. And for those that don't know, by this whole idea of dilution, we're talking about companies that are so small that they will eventually run out of money. They're trying to do something. They'll run out of money. They'll need to raise more money by issuing new stock. So, they literally create new shares and then they sell them and they raise money that way. And that obviously creates a larger pool of total shares, which means that your percentage of the pie goes down. So that's what we mean by dilution, just raising money over time.
Yep.
But yeah, I'm the same. And that's what stung me out actually in one of the few early investments. It was Sky and Space Global. Mm. They said they had enough money to do what they wanted to do. They didn't. And they just kept raising more money. And people just kept getting more and more ticked off because they kept saying, yeah, we got enough money. And then they would raise.
Yeah.
Oh, we got enough money. Don't worry. Another raise.
Yeah.
Management's paying themselves big fat bonuses. They're running low on cash. Another raise.
Yeah.
And investors just got fed up after a while because, yeah, they didn't show the results.
Yeah. And I mean, the same thing happened with companies during the pandemic. Is companies that were loaded on debt and didn't have a cash buffer, when COVID hit, they had to raise capital. And that killed a lot of shareholders. It diluted them. Whereas businesses that had a bit of cash around, no debts, they could weather a short period of tough time without diluting the shareholders, without having to raise more capital.
Yeah.
And the difference is night and day between the returns of those companies.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, crazy. All right, guys. Well, that will just about do us for today. I actually have to run right now, so I'm going to wrap things up very quickly. but yeah, make sure if you have a question, just drop it in the comments of the most recent YouTube version of the podcast or ask it on Spotify in the question box on Spotify. But apart from that, thanks very much for tuning in. We ended up going for more than an hour. We thought we were going to run short on this episode.
Surprise.
But no, we ended up running very... there was a lot to talk about. It's good when we start to just yarn on stuff as opposed to just getting through the news.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, guys, thanks very much for tuning in. We do appreciate the hour of your time you give us each and every week. And with that said, we'll see you guys in the next one.
See you guys.